Spring into reading this season with the Biblio Lifestyle 2024 Spring Reading Guide. In this season's guide, I've handpicked 21 of the best new books and I've organized them across 6 categories. So whether you're looking for a romance novel that will give you a happily ever after, a thrilling mystery to keep you guessing, or an immersive historical fiction book, this guide has a book or 3 or 7 just for you. Now, if 21 books sounds like too much for you, there's a minimalist reads list in the guide, which includes a list of 6 must-read books from across genres. But wait, that's not all. The Spring Reading Guide also includes fun recipes, spring activities, and lifestyle tips. So head on over to springreadingguide.com and download your copy of the guide. That's springreadingguide.com and download your free copy of the 2024 Spring Reading Guide. So download your free copy and discover your next favorite book. Happy reading! Hello, I'm Victoria from Biblio Lifestyle, and you're listening to the Reader's Couch podcast, the show that will help you bridge the gap between living a full and busy life to one where you're reading, learning new things, and having fun. Today on the couch, I'm so excited to welcome author Laurie Frankel to talk about her novel, Family Family. Now, you might recognize the name Laurie Frankel, as she's the author of 1, 2, 3, This Is How It Always Is, Goodbye For Now, and The Atlas of Love. And if you've read any of her books, you know a Laurie Frankel book when you read it, and this one is no different. In Family Family, we meet India Allwood, a successful actor who faces online backlash over her new movie, which centers on the topic of adoption, and folks online accuse her of capitalizing on others' trauma. Now, India's adopted daughter, Fig, seeks to help her mother by reaching out to the daughter India gave up for adoption as a teen, but of course, things don't go according to plan. But as the story unfolds, what we get is a humorous and thought-provoking portrayal of adoptive parenting that also showcases the complexities and dynamics within those relationships. So in this episode, Laurie and I talk about her new book, her experiences as an adoptive mother, and how it shaped this novel. And we also circle back to her previous books, get book recommendations, and lots more. But before we get in today's episode, pretty please subscribe to the Reader's Couch podcast if you haven't already. Leave the podcast a 5-star rating and write me a review if you love the show. Alrighty, friends, that's it. And now, on to the episode with author Laurie Frankel. Hi, readers. Welcome again to the Reader's Couch. I'm your host, Victoria Wood. And here on the couch with me to talk about her new novel, Family Family, is author Laurie Frankel. Hi, Laurie. Welcome to the Reader's Couch.
Hi, Victoria. Thank you so much for having me.
Yay, I'm thrilled to have you on. Can't wait to talk about Family Family. But I know this isn't your first rodeo, but I'm always interested in how authors are feeling. Tell me about this one. How are you feeling? How excited are you? Tell me about it all.
I'm very excited. I'm mildly terrified. I'm slightly panicked, which is exactly how I think I always feel when the book is first out. It is a very strange thing, I think, no matter how many times you do it, because it's been in my head for almost 4 years now. And now all of a sudden it's in the world. And that feels scary, I think, every time, and really just different. It's very strange to take it from being only in you to being out there for everyone.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I kind of feel like this one is incredibly special, but I want them to hear it straight from you. Tell us about Family Family. What's your elevator pitch, and what can readers expect when they pick up a copy?
Yes, thank you. I hope it is special. I hope that people will love it. It is a book about, well, it's a book about family, but a different kind of family. And it is a book about adoption, but a different kind of adoption as well. I think so often the messaging that we get and the stories that we get surrounding adoption is really negative. Either it's actually very negative. It's this, you know, very sad story about a person who can't find their way in the world because they have no family, that sort of adoption narrative. Or it's this family has learned to live with this challenge and they love each other, even though they've settled for this subpar way of making a family. And I hate those stories. So I wanted to tell a story about adoption that wasn't settled for, that wasn't second best, but that was still complicated and fraught and difficult because it's a story about family and families are complicated and fraught and difficult.
I think that can be said for all families, you know,
yes.
Where all odd in our own way. We have our quirks. We are different, but that should be the case because we're all individually unique. And I see that through your characters. So we have India, we have Fig, and we have Rebecca. So I want us to start with India. India, she's an actor and stars as a woman who gave up her daughter for adoption. And India is receiving backlash from folks online about her character. So before we get into her daughter, Fig and Rebecca, let's just talk about India, who she is, her life prior to being an actor, then doing this show, and then all the social media backlash.
Yes, yeah. And India is really the protagonist. She's not always the one telling the story. The story really is told by a round of characters. But I do think she's the kind of heart of this thing. I do think she's the protagonist. And we get two different timelines. One is in the present, but one is in the past. And so we get India from middle school forward, really. And we see her grow up. And she determines at about age 10, that the only thing she wants to do is star in shows on Broadway. But she realizes along the way that she can't sing and that therefore she has to become a serious actress. And when I started writing the book, the very, very early scene in the book is her in high school sitting outside auditions for Guys and Dolls, which she can't get cast in because she can't sing. And at first I thought this is just a story about, you know, this early disappointment for this girl. And then I thought, wait, what if she's right? What if she really is going to be the actor of her generation? What if she is an extraordinary talent and she's going to grow up and star in shows on Broadway and move to Hollywood? It's just that she can't get cast in her high school show. And what she learns there, what I learned about her there is that she can do a lot of things, but she's got to work really, really hard for them. And so in many ways, I feel like it is a book about the ways in which talent and passion are great, but they're not enough because you also need really hard work, and the ways in which dream jobs are really dreamy, but they're also jobs. And that's how she gets in trouble, is the ways in which there's all of these other aspects to her career, being this public-facing person, that are really, really difficult, hard work.
Absolutely, for sure, for sure. Another person worth noting is Fig. So Fig is India's daughter. I found it quite interesting, her being a fifth grader. Fifth grade is incredibly challenging in itself. We get to see some of that. Tell us about Fig.
Yes, Fig is 10. And it's in some ways not the most important part about her, but in other ways, it really is. She's very smart. She's very precocious. She's well-read. Strives to know a lot of things. When we meet her, she's reading the newspaper, but she's still 10. And I am often writing about smart kids. I am really interested in smart kids as both characters and, I don't know, like humans living in my house. I think we often are selling kids short because they're children and they don't know as much necessarily. They don't have as many experiences, but therefore I think they often, present us with this view of the world that is, I mean, I don't want to say it's purer or it's more innocent. It's not nearly that cheesy. It's just like they approach things with fewer preconceptions, but also with fewer social constraints, I think, than adults do. She's 10. She doesn't have to earn a living. She doesn't have to you know, negotiate all of the things that her, she didn't have to support a family. She, you know, she also is not yet a teenager. So I think there are fewer social pressures. And therefore we get from Fig, I think, a different perspective than we're used to. I also really love writing in children's voices because I think they're endlessly fascinating. And so she too narrates a lot of this book in a close third person, that I love. I mean, I think of her a lot. I miss her now. I'm not writing her anymore.
I really still do think about Fig again. Her age is not important, but it's also very important as well, just kind of getting that perspective, because when you contrast Fig to Rebecca, who is a teen,
yeah,
who is a bit headstrong, who has a story to tell, who has her own opinions, you know, it's quite the contrast. So tell us about Rebecca.
Yes. Yeah, so Rebecca is 16 and she is the child who India places for adoption her senior year of high school. So when she herself is 16, and that has been a secret. And then as in novels all the time, that secret ceases to be a secret. And it's some of what's driving the book. Going into it, Rebecca's relationship with India, with her birth mother, is very important. And it's something that they both need to negotiate and figure out over the course of this book. But going into it, I was especially interested in the relationship between Rebecca and Fig, because we don't talk a lot about that relationship. At one point, they observe that there's no name for your birth mother's kid. They're not siblings. They're not actually related genetically. And they don't actually know each other. They haven't actually met each other in real life at the start of the book. That happens over the course of the story. And so they share neither nature nor nurture. And yet they share this remarkable thing, which is in some ways, they have the same mother, though in other ways they don't at all. And all of that seemed really interesting to me going in. And really, even aside from all of that complication, I think always that relationship between 10-year-olds and 16-year-olds is really fascinating. You know, later in life, as you get older, that 6-year age gap is nothing. But at that age, it's huge. And I remember that. I remember being on the cusp of being an older kid and looking up to those teenagers and thinking they were so old and they knew so much. But in fact, the reader looks at the 16-year-old and thinks she's so young and knows so little. And therefore there's a lot of fun to have there.
Yes, absolutely. It's funny because that was something I was just chatting with my husband about the other day, in that a 3-year age difference is huge when you're little. You know, one's 5, one's 8, one's 10, one's 13.
Yeah.
But when you're in your 30s and in your 40s, it's nothing.
Yeah.
So just kind of seeing that dynamic between Rebecca and Fig, I agree. It was very interesting. Being the youngest sibling, you perceive the world very differently, as does the elder sibling. But to kind of just catch our listeners up, essentially, India is an actor, is acting in this movie where in the movie, she gives up her daughter for adoption. In real life, she gave up her daughter for adoption, just like you said. And her daughter at present is adopted. So it's clear to say, yes, this is a book all about family, but also it's a story of adoption. Tell me about the adoption storyline and why was this so important to you? And how does your real life mirror what we're seeing in the book?
So I have an adopted child. So I am myself a member of an adoptive family. And I am frustrated by the narratives available to us. There's certainly no shortage of books for kids and for adults where the moral of the story is this child is adopted, but they love each other anyway. But she found love in this family anyway. Or, you know, yes, this birth mother really, really struggled but ultimately, overcame. It's not that those aren't important and necessary stories. They are important and necessary stories, but it is frustrating to me that they're the only stories and that we always, always get the narrative of adoptive families are settled for. They are second best. Isn't it remarkable how they managed to seem like a real family, even though they're not quite? And I find that really, really puzzling. You know, not least because we like to hold up family as the most important thing. We say of a really close friend, she's like a sister to me, even as we might not have a relationship with our actual sister at all. You know, we talk a lot about chosen family, by which we mean really good friends, and which is often in contrast to the people to whom we're actually blood related, with whom we often have really complicated, difficult, often, frankly, crappy relationships. And that is a strange dissonance to me. And so I wanted to talk about it. And I didn't want to be preachy. I didn't want to say, oh, you know, these families are all sunshine and roses, and because that's not true either, because they're families. I want to say these families are just as complicated as any other kind of family. And that's a good thing, not a bad thing. And let's talk about it. Let's have a conversation. Let's talk about the ways in which these kids have different needs and the ways in which these kids have the same needs and how to best meet, negotiate all of that.
Absolutely. Again, I'm a firm believer. Families are very odd. We're quirky. We're weird. We're complicated. There's so many layers, and there really shouldn't be a barrier, because I love your mentioning of how we casually say, oh, this person is like family to me, and the found family, both in books and in real life. And there are complications there. So why should adoption be any different?
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm also curious about your choice to let this whole story, the drama behind it, in terms of, you know, India, Fig, Rebecca, and everything playing out online. Tell me about the online landscape and your choice to just kind of have everything unravel there, because India is the actor who's receiving backlash online for her role in her film. But we also see Rebecca having quite a bit to say, who also turns online and has her own story to tell. So tell me about the online landscape.
Yes, it's, you know, I think, you know, as with family, where there are good sides and bad sides and good things and bad things. And, you know, lots that is wonderful and nurturing and lots that is difficult and fraught. This is true of social media as well, for sure. There are lots of ways in which in life and in this story, social media affords connections that would not be available otherwise and allows people who would not necessarily have a voice to have a voice, to communicate with lots and lots of people, to get their stories out, to get the word out, to connect with one another. And all of that is a really wonderful thing. And yet, there is also, I am telling no one anything they don't know, a very dark side of social media. And living online in general, there are lots of things that are enormously problematic. And what India finds is that because she is wildly famous and successful, which is largely a good thing, there's also this really terrible part about being wildly famous and successful, which is that she's no longer entitled to an opinion. And her expressing, you know, what seems to her to be both true and not that big of a deal, these ideas online, gets her in a world of trouble. And then she's expected to apologize for it when she hasn't done anything wrong. And then doing so gets her in more trouble. And she pisses off some people, and in trying to explain herself, only ends up pissing off more and more and more and more people. And this impacts her livelihood, and it impacts her family. And all of that is really essentially part of her job at this point, all of which I think is really interesting and multi-sided, which is what I am. You know, I'm always interested in writing about. I get really bored when it's just good guys and bad guys. really bored when it's forces of good and forces of evil. And the online world is a little bit of both. And that makes it a good thing to wrestle with.
Absolutely. And that's one thing I think readers, especially readers of your books, can expect is always those layers. You're very good at giving us layers. You're very good at giving us those nuances to the story. And I couldn't agree with you more. Social media is quite the landscape. So I'm also thinking there's no other place this could have happened as right. well.
Yes, yes. It's a mixed bag. It is definitely, you know, classically a mixed bag. And I think that there are fewer people anymore who don't know that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't think that the internet has this reputation for being all good. I don't know if it ever did, but I certainly think it doesn't anymore. I don't think when I say, oh, there's this dark side of social media, I don't think anyone is like, oh, what are you talking about? I think we know this. And yet we use it anyhow. We can no longer opt out of it. It's no longer optional. And so that seems to me, I mean, again, it's great because like, great, let's have a conversation. Let's talk about it and look at this. But we are no longer in a position where we can say, you know what, I have some real qualms about this, and I think I would like to not use it anymore. Opting out is not really an option for lots and lots of people. And when we are using something that we all acknowledge is really, really problematic and bad for us in lots and lots of ways, but we have no choice but to engage with it, you know, then I think, okay, well, let's talk about that. That's something we ought to be having a conversation about.
You know, I love how you said that the internet never really had a reputation as something good, because that's what my girlfriends and I often chat about, is when the internet first became a thing and you're really thinking, you know, especially in the 90s when it really, in my opinion, exploded, and then early 2000s and you had social, you know, the first iterations of like online messengers. We were talking about online messengers the other day. And I said, I don't know about y'all, but I was raised that the internet, you know, like the bogeyman's on there, it's going to come get you. Yeah. They're bad people. I think that was the thing. It was more like, they're bad people on the internet. They're going to come get you. They're going to come find you. Something bad is, you know, just bad things. And I even think back to when online dating had started and just how paranoid we were when a girl in our friend group was like, she's going to go meet a stranger she met online. I'm like, wait, what? Yeah. You know, it was just, it. So for me, the internet, you know, was different. So then now to kind of see it evolve where, okay, we're gathering over interests a la Bookstagram, BookTok, and all these different things. I'm like, okay, we're meeting people in real life, which I've now done.
You are.
Oh, wonderful, you know. We yes. meet all British friends online, which again, you know, had you told me that 20 years, no, 10 years ago, I would have been like, 15 years ago, I'm like, no, you're crazy. So we've seen the internet evolve, but then also, though, I find those happy bits, there are the problematic bits as well. So it's quite the landscape, I tell you, quite the landscape.
Quite the landscape, yes. And I also remember at the beginning, you know, in the 90s, we were talking about when the point that everybody wanted to make was like, you too can have a blog. You don't need to have a newspaper. You don't need to have a television station. All you need to do is log on. Everyone can talk. Everyone has a voice. This very egalitarian fantasy. And that wasn't true either. You know, of course it wasn't. And in some ways, I suppose we're still in early days, all of which is to say it is complicated, and you're right. That's what I like to write about. I want to talk about, I don't want there to be an easy answer. In fact, I don't even want to give an answer. I just want to ask some questions. I want to think about some things from a few different perspectives and see where we are.
Yes, let's have a conversation about it. And on that note, I mean, again, for readers who are familiar with you and your work, that's a Laurie Frankel novel. So previous books you have, for listeners who are not familiar, so 1, 2, 3 was your last one before Family, then This Is How It Always Is, that's another book, Goodbye for Now, The Atlas of Love. Tell our readers, what are the similarities that they can find within your work?
Yes, gosh, I would love to. I think that the thesis of all of my novels, of which this is my fifth, is wider ranges of normal, make the world a better place for everyone. And so the particular, these things about us that we think are strange and weird, and we might be the only one, and we might be embarrassed, and we might even be ashamed, and it might even be dangerous, are in fact, we're not only not alone in that, it's like that for everybody. And it might not be like that for everybody on this particular front, but everyone finds themselves outside of whatever box would like to be ticked sometimes. Sometimes you can't pick A or B. Sometimes you are at the end of whatever spectrum. Sometimes you are weird. And that's a good thing, not a bad thing. And that is true for everyone. So the more we acknowledge that and talk about it and allow for it and account for it and celebrate it, the better the world gets for everybody. I also think that these books are all about non-traditional families, which is something else that I am always on about and always interested in. And as you say, or as I say, as one of us has said, you know, these issues that that are complicated and difficult and not easy to land on one side or the other side. And in fact, when I go in and it seems to me that it is very clearly one side or the other side, I find other ways to complicate it. I find other ways to make it less clear because I think it's more interesting. I think it's the work of a novel. I think I need 350 pages and 10 hours of your time. I can't do it in a tweet. I'm not interested in it. If it's just a reaction, if you can like it or unlike it with a click, then it needn't be book length. And I want it to be big and long.
Big and long is fine with me because I like it. And I think that's why we're book people and we're readers and we gather and just commune around books is because we want more than just a caption, a tweet, or a quick reaction. So
yes.
Even though we can't opt out of it, we can opt into books and we can stay opted into that one for sure. So I'm greedy. I love looking ahead as well. I love looking forward to books and reading the next Lori Frankel. So are you working on any other projects? What can you tell us? Manuscripts, submissions, what's going on?
I'm working on the next one, but I'm not talking about it yet. In part, but I think that writers are often really superstitious about not talking about works in progress. And for me, it's not that at all. It's just that it changes so much over the course of the book for me over the course of the drafting process that I'm probably wrong about what I think I'm writing at this juncture. So we'll have to see what happens. This new book, Family, I cut 300,000 words from over the course of drafting. So I just am often wrong going in about what the thing is about and the direction that it's going. So I'm not talking about it yet until I find out.
Okay, so not superstitious, but just things might change.
Yes, but I appreciate your asking, and I appreciate people looking forward to the next one. I think means the world.
Yes, we do that as readers. We find something, we latch on, and then we're like, okay, when's the next one?
Yes, absolutely, yes.
That's us for sure. Okay, so looking back, because now, you know, you have five books. There's Family, which we're here talking about. 1, 2, 3, which I absolutely loved.
Thank you.
Is How It Always Is. Love that one too. Goodbye For Now and The Atlas of Love. Haven't read those yet, but that's fine. There is time. But looking back at your body of work, and you're working on something new now, even though, again, that might change a bit too. But looking back, if you could tell your younger writing self, what would you tell her?
This is an interesting question. In some ways, I feel like it would be really lovely to tell my younger self, you're gonna grow up and become a novelist. Because I would have who wouldn't love to know that at age, you know, 15, 10? It would be an amazing thing to know that going in. But I wonder if I could still have done it. I wrote my first novel without any confidence that I had any ability to write. I didn't know whether or not I could write a novel. I think if you want to know whether or not you can write a poem, you can sit down and try to write a poem. I think if you want to know if you can write a short story, you can sit down and try to write a short story. It's not going to be good necessarily, but you know, but you could try. I don't think there's any way to know whether or not you can write a novel without doing it, because it's long. It's, you know, it's, there's no way to practice quickly. You got to kind of commit to it. And I definitely think with that first one, and in some ways with everyone thereafter, there's part of me that thinks, I don't know whether I can do this. And that not knowing drives it to some extent. And certainly the first time there was no pressure, which I wonder if it didn't make it that possible, perhaps. So that is a really interesting question, and I'm not sure I know the answer.
That's fine with me. That's fine with me. Sometimes I'm like, do I want to know? Do I want to go back in time? Do I want to nudge myself on something? One, I wouldn't listen anyway.
Sure, yes. Definitely true.
Hard-headed, would not listen.
Especially at 15, yes.
I'm for sure softened as I've aged, but definitely not that younger version. No, she doesn't want to hear anything at all. But what I do want to hear about is your reading life, Laurie. So even though we're here to chat about your new book, tell me about the last books that you finished reading that you would now recommend.
Oh, yes. Gosh, I would love to. I am recommending to everyone these days Lauren Grodstein's new book, We Must Not Think of Ourselves. It's historical fiction. It's about the Warsaw Ghetto. It is really a perfect novel in a lot of ways. What do I want to say about its perfection? It is very streamlined. It is very simple. It is very direct. It is incredibly beautiful and moving. It's about the Warsaw Ghetto, but it is uplifting, and that is because it is character driven. There are no pyrotechnics. It isn't flashy. It isn't doing anything tricky. It is just this very straightforward, kind of perfect novel. I am also recommending Naomi Alderman's new book, The Future, which is maybe the opposite. It's big and sprawling and full of pyrotechnics and tricks and things you don't see coming. It is a remarkable novel. I loved it. I had an early read of it. I got an advanced copy. And so I read it in, I don't know, maybe October-ish. And then the book came out finally in November. I got my hands on it and just sat down and read it again, because I missed so much. There's so much going on, and I missed so much of it the first time. And I really, really loved it. I am always recommending Percival Everett to everyone. And his book that is out in a couple of months is called James. It's Huckleberry Finn from Jim's point of view, is also a remarkable book. And Percival Everett is one where, if you haven't done the backlist, like, good news, he's got 30 some novels, all of which are different than anything else I ever read. And so I'm always pushing him on anyone who will sit still long enough to listen.
I am one of those people working through the Percival Everett.
Yes. Yes.
So good.
It's
so good.
So good. And there's so much of it. I mean, I'm a devotee, and I too am working through the backlist because there's so much of it. You know, the movie just came out based on Erasure. The movie is called American Fiction. And
yes.
And so I'm hoping that's going to open up Percival Everett's backlist to some people who hadn't otherwise heard of him. Though I think James is also going to do the trick.
True, true. I think James will do the trick. I got an early copy, but yes, I'm working my way through the backlist. I can't wait to one day say, I read them all.
Oh, we have a club like the Percival Everett Completist Club. I love this idea.
Listen, I live for stuff like that. I live to read through authors' backlist. Yeah. I will wait. Listen, I might not do it all at once, but I'm telling you, I just take my time. I work through different people.
Yeah.
I circle back. And yes, yeah, so I'm part of that completionist society, wherever they are.
Yeah.
So good. I'm looking forward to the movie too. So.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. Very excited. Looking forward to that. What would you say was your favorite childhood book?
Oh, gosh. I mean, It's hard to narrow it down. I read a lot as a child, and I read a lot now. and so it's hard to narrow down to one. I loved the Ramona Quimby books. I loved all of those books, the Beverly Cleary, also someone who has written many, many novels, and I'm a completist on that. I read them all. I read them again and again as a child. I became fixated on books from a very early age. When my parents were reading to me, they are often complaining still that they would finish a book and I would just request the same book again and again and again so that they could recite Madeline and Mary Poppins and Where the Wild Things Are and Ferdinand, like these books that I just wanted over and over and over and over again. And even as they read to me, as the books got like a little bit longer, I remember them reading The Jungle Book to me and getting to the end of it and just wanting them to start it again. And I think that's a really I feel like it says something about my personality, and it would be an interesting litmus test for people. Like, do you get to the end of a story and think, that was so great, I want a new story? Or do you get to the end of a story you love and think, that was so great, I want a new story? Or do you get to the end of a story you love and think, that was so great, I want to read it again? And I certainly go both directions at now, but as a child, I definitely wanted the same thing over and over.
Yeah, I was that child too. I would finish. So I would always be gifted a book for every occasion. So it's a book and something else. I don't know what the something else is. And obviously, I don't know what book I'm going to be gifted. I just know it's a book and it's something else. And I was that person who would race through. I would open the book package first because you could tell it was a book back then. Yes. My parents were putting things in boxes or any of that. No. So I would open that first, just so I could start reading. And I would get so excited. I'd spend the entire day reading. Then I'd get to the end and then I'd go back in bed and I'd start again.
Yeah. It's the best, right? It's the best. And I agree with you completely. And me too. That's what I give my kid also. All holidays, whatever they are, there will be other gifts, but there will also be books no matter what.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So tell us about some of your favorite indie bookstores, either local or on your visits and travels. Tell us about your favorites.
So I live in Seattle, which is lucky. We are lucky to be blessed with a lot of really wonderful independent bookstores. I have one that is just up the hill from me called Queen Anne Book Company, which is a small indie bookstore, one of these like perfect little bookstores where someone has curated. So it doesn't have everything, but someone has culled. They've gotten rid of the cruddy books and left you with these wonderful books that they've chosen. And there's something really amazing about being able to walk to your bookstore, that it is truly, truly a neighborhood bookstore. You're going to run into people you know everybody who works there. I'm very, very lucky to have it. But Seattle is full of really wonderful bookstores. And I'm lucky actually to know a lot of people who work at a lot of them. Elliott Bay is our big bookstore. It's where I launch my books. And it's where lots of authors come through. And so it's where I have done a lot of in conversations with a lot of visiting authors, where I've met a lot of people. It turns out to be a gathering place where you gather with other authors and other writers and talk about books and writing with people who love to talk about books and writing. And very, very lucky to have it nearby.
Oh, yes, that's an absolute treat. I mean, just how amazing, how amazing. Okay, getting back to your book though, Family, look, I know you've done your job, you've written it, you've given it to us, we've chatted about it a bit today, but what are you hoping for in an ideal world that readers might think or feel, or just, you know, just some conversations that you're hoping they might have after they've turned the last page?
You know, mostly I hope that it's a good read. I hope that you turn the pages and you're happy while you're doing it, and you feel like you're being told a good story. You're in capable hands. I'm going to get you from the beginning to the end of this thing in a way that is going to feel that's going to feed you, I guess. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think sometimes you're reading a book and you're like, yes, okay, I know that this is good, but it's a slog. And I don't ever want that to be the case. I want you to be happily turning pages. But at the end, I want you to feel moved. I want you to feel like, oh, this all came together. I want you to feel like you've thought about some things that maybe you wouldn't have thought about otherwise. And you've considered some things from some perspectives that you didn't necessarily have going in. It isn't didactic. I'm certainly not lecturing. I just myself as a reader, I like to finish a book open rather than closed. I want questions rather than answers. I want to feel like I learned something and I grew a little bit and I had a good time doing it. That is what I hope. That is what I'm always hoping for readers of my own books. And it is what I'm always hoping for as a reader myself.
Love hearing that. This one for sure gave me a lot of feelings, a lot of thoughts, but you know what? It also made me smile. There's some humor in there as well. But like the title said, Family, Family, it's ultimately, in my opinion, a novel about family and just how unusual we all are. But you know what? It's a good thing too. Laurie, thank you so much for coming on the show and speaking with me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Victoria, right back at you. Thank you for having me and thank you for doing this. And it is a joy to talk to you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Reader's Couch podcast. Please subscribe to the show, share it with a friend, and take a few seconds to leave a rating and review. Until next time, stay lounging, stay reading, and whenever you're in doubt, go straight to your local bookstore or library. Thanks again for listening, and happy reading.